Hi, welcome to the new Givergy podcast season, the secret guide to fundraising. I'm Ben, Givergy COO, and as a team of fundraising experts, we help clients worldwide raise as much money as possible. This is possible thanks to our award-winning platform and our team's consultative approach, which provide the tools to raise more online and at events. Our clients always comment on how helpful our advice is, so we wanted to share some exclusive insights into our latest podcast series, which will get behind the scenes of modern fundraising. We're excited to share our fundraising best practices, tips, and tricks through this medium, so sit back and enjoy the show. In today's episode, we are talking about narratives. We think storytelling is the best way to get the donors to support a cause. But what does that look like in a rapidly changing digital age? We're joined by marketing extraordinaire and non-profit digital consultant, Julia Campbell. We'll discuss how effective storytelling and leveraging digital channels can also help nonprofits connect with donors on a deeper level and create a sense of emotional investment in their cause. How are you doing, Julia?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
No, we're super, super excited to have you with us and excited to talk all about storytelling.
Love it.
Well, before we do, we want to find out a little bit more about you. So how did it all start? How did you become a fundraiser?
I actually have been an activist. I've worked in nonprofits and social causes since I was in high school, and I started a recycling program at my high school back in the 90s. And then I've always been just really trying to be on the forefront of a lot of social causes and just really trying to fight for social justice in a lot of different areas. But when I started my journey as a fundraiser, I would say it really began when I served in the Peace Corps, so the U.S. Peace Corps, which is a program run by the State Department where Americans go abroad to the developing world for 2 years, 2.5 years. And I spent my time in Senegal and West Africa. And I worked with a lot of NGOs and a lot of organizations there on fundraising projects. And I kind of got my taste of how to craft that appeal, how to tell that story, and what really kind of worked. And then when I came home, I worked for universities and small organizations, community-based organizations, mid-sized organizations, really ranging causes ranging from domestic violence to animal rights to educational equity. And then I settled on going off on my own about 13 years ago. And I've been a speaker and a consultant ever since.
Wow. What an interesting journey. What was it like being on the ground in Africa and kind of experiencing that?
What's so interesting about that is that really did help me segue into storytelling. So I'm a journalist by trade. That's what I studied in school. I thought I was going to travel the world with National Geographic or Rolling Stone and write these amazing, long journalistic pieces, these big exposés. And that's what I had my heart on doing, was writing and storytelling. And then when I arrived in Senegal, what's so interesting about the Peace Corps is that you do spend so much time there. You're not a tourist. You actually live in a village with a family, and you have to learn the language and the customs and the etiquette. And everything is based on storytelling. Everything is based on, you know, authenticity and credibility. So for me, I had to find the people in my village that had that authenticity and credibility and help them tell the story of what we were trying to do, whether it was malaria prevention. We were really focused on malaria prevention at the time, getting people to use bed nets, getting people to use bug spray, you know, getting people to get rid of the water, that little like standing potable like water that was everywhere, like puddles, because that breeds malaria larvae. So just really getting those stories out there and helping train other people on how to do that. It's almost like public health marketing, which is really interesting. So I think that was my first foray into that. But stories is just stories, especially where I lived in Senegal and West Africa. That was the way that knowledge was communicated and the way that sort of values were passed down generation to generation. It was just really interesting. So I think the combination of that with my journalism interest and passion and background, and then my kindled love for fundraising, I think it all has come together into the work I do today.
I love it. I feel like you've kind of been filling up a toolbox as you've been going through life, and you've been dropping all these nuggets in, and it sounds like you're all the OG journalist turned fundraiser turned, you know, Greenpeace activist, the whole shebang in one person.
I think what's interesting, especially about all the fundraisers I talk to, is everyone says they're an accidental fundraiser. And I know that nowadays you can go to school and get a degree in fundraising. There's all these certificate programs. I think those are fantastic. But when I started out, there was no certificate program. There was no like MBA in fundraising. You had to figure it out as you went. You had to piecemeal it, look online, read books, talk to other people, and try to figure it out as you went. Although I think a lot of people do that now. But so many people fall into it because they're interested in making a difference and they believe in the power of philanthropy. And I certainly do.
And I guess, sorry, Ben. You go.
No, I was just going to say, I guess from sort of being there and seeing how it makes such a difference with the people that you're living with in the community really then helps make a difference in how you tell that story. You know, I think sometimes from a fundraiser's point of view, unless they've sort of been and really sort of got to see what they're doing and how that makes a difference, it's more challenging to tell that story. So I'm sure that had a sort of big impact on the way you were able to do that.
Exactly. And that's the problem, I think, especially with American fundraising, are the silos. So my very first director of development job, I worked at a domestic violence program. I was living in Virginia. My office was physically like two blocks away from where anything took place, from the executive director, from any of the programs that were occurring, from the reception, from the children's program. So it was like, okay, go over here, close your door, don't speak to anybody, and raise $2 million. Thank you. Goodbye. Like, we'll give you resources, but we're not going to speak to you. Like, go perform some miracles. I think that's what tends to happen in fundraising. And my goal with the work that I do is really to help break down those silos and help people understand that storytelling, marketing, fundraising, it's all pieces of the same puzzle, and they should all be working together and not at kind of cross purposes.
Wow, we're getting into the meat of it. So
yes.
Before we do, though, there is two things I wanted to share with our listeners. Can you just tell us a little bit more about your agency in terms of, you know, how hot are you now supporting nonprofits?
So I started out as a freelance writer because, like I said, I love writing. And I did that for quite a while. That was back when you could use Craigslist for legitimate things. I'm not sure if you can use Craigslist anymore for that. But I would just put up my shingle and say, I'm a freelance grant writer. I could write some fundraising copy for you. I can write your email newsletter, you know, let me know. And then that really transformed into understanding that organizations have more deep-seated issues than just copywriting. They really don't understand fundraising communication strategy. And then this was back when social media was really exploding. Blogs were incredibly popular. And a lot of nonprofits were kind of scrambling to figure out, how are we going to exist in the digital age? How are we going to stand out? Which platforms should we use? What are we going to talk about? Who are we connecting with? Like, how are we building our brand and our presence using our website and email and social media? So that's how I developed the consultancy that I have right now. I really help people figure out all of the digital pieces, create a plan and a communication strategy for their particular organization. I also do a lot of speaking, and I have online courses, and I have two books for nonprofits, one on storytelling and one on social media. So it all sort of came together out of, I would say, the frequently asked questions, the questions that I was getting, the things I was seeing online, and the struggles and the challenges that I saw my clients facing and I saw other people in the sector facing, and just trying to create a lot of content around that.
I love it. You've, again, so much to offer, so many options. So we'll be sure to get people directed to your website at the end to help, especially some of those resources that you mentioned. So we're going to dive right into it. So my first question is, when we chat about storytelling at our Future of Fundraising events and in our wider communications, we always receive positive feedback from our clients. But the consensus is that it allows donors to build a stronger connection. However, as not all charities have a marketing function, do you think that storytelling is a nice to have, or is it essential within today's fundraising landscape?
I think it's absolutely essential. So I don't think you can make a genuine connection in today's day and age without a story. If you think about, you know, how humans have communicated since the dawn of time, we've communicated in stories. Like, think about how you talk to your best friends, or even calling your mother or talking to your neighbor. It always starts with a story. How are you? Oh, we went on vacation. We did this. Or I'm really struggling at work because this coworker did this. Or it's how we communicate and process information. The key with storytelling that I always try to impart, the importance of it, is that not only will it grab attention, it's helpful for people to process that information and also retain it. So if you think about news articles that you've read, I was just recently reading one on the dam break in Ukraine, and it's so hard to process what that looks like, who, you know, who's affected. But when you hear a story of a family, a person that was personally affected by this tragedy, you know, by this huge event, that's going to help not only drive it home, but also help you remember and help you process it so you can take action on it. So I think storytelling, and I know storytelling, helps us contextualize hard to grasp information, especially on the issues that nonprofits are dealing with, like ending homelessness and fighting food insecurity, violence and racial equity. Those are such huge terms that it's so hard to understand, like ending homelessness. But when you hear a story of a person who's experiencing homelessness or who is experiencing abuse and, you know, substance misuse treatment and what they're going through, you can really relate it to something in your life. And it's so interesting that people think, oh, storytelling is just storytelling. But it really is the perfect marketing strategy because it grabs attention. It gets people to understand the problem, and it creates that empathy that is required for someone to take an action.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, like you said there about being relatable, that's what's so important, because, you know, as soon as it becomes a human and, you know, they've previously gone about their day-to-day life, similar to what you have, and then they're in a different situation, that's like, you know, when you can really understand why it's so important. So I think that relatable bit that you mentioned there is key in that storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And what is just, I think, you know, when we think about our audience, you know, our listeners, over 70% of our clients are small to medium charities, but really they're actually quite small. So it could just be, let's just say it could be a hospice or a kind of one-off building. And a lot of fundraisers I meet, I'll talk to them and I'll be like, I'm really excited because I want to try and do everything. And then I'm like, well, who does this? And they're like, me. Who does this?
Yes.
Me.
Yes.
And I realize it's like a one-woman show.
Yes.
Somehow, you know, he or she is pulling off this whole function of fundraising on their own. And quite often, one of the biggest challenges is just budget to be able to get. But are there any tips you can give people in that situation who really want to do what you're saying? So, you know, there's lots more we're going to talk about, but don't really have the budget to be able to yet have a marketing department?
Planning is key. So looking at what other organizations are doing and not working from a blank page, because you'll get overwhelmed. So you know, most likely you're on social media, at least maybe one platform. You get some email newsletters. You might watch TV, you might watch the news. Just look at all of the different information coming at you. Look at the stories that are resonating with you and kind of write them down and kind of maybe take some notes. So I think research is the biggest piece, listening and just figuring out what are some examples that I think we could incorporate in our organization. Because working from this blank page where you think, oh, I have to collect the stories, craft the stories, share the stories, that gets overwhelming. So doing some research and then just look at the low-hanging fruit. So is there a program officer that you are close to? Or is there an alumni? Is there a board member? Is there a volunteer even? So the low-hanging fruit for storytelling is really staff. It might even be you. What is your story? What resonates with you about working at this organization? What were you most scared of when you started? What has been the most impactful experience that you've had? What inspires you to wake up and go to work every day? Like, those are really great stories to hear. They don't always have to be client stories. They don't always have to be these, you know, heartstring pulling stories of a woman that came to the food bank with her three children and got some food. It really could be, what's the founder's story? Why does this organization exist? What is the gap you're trying to fill? What is the vision that you have for the future? How are you working towards this vision? All of that is storytelling. You know, it doesn't have to be the hero's journey. And I know we get taught that, like the Joseph Campbell hero's journey, which is the traditional Luke Skywalker, you know, Bilbo Baggins, Katniss Everdeen. You know, we get sold this, it has to be this transitional, transformative story. It really doesn't. It really could be, what is an experience or a memory or something that inspired you? And just speaking human to human, even that little tiny moment, those two sentences, that can be transformative. So I think starting with who in your organization is willing to share their story and doing a lot of just prep work before you're even willing to share it, and not thinking about it as marketing or fundraising, thinking about it as creating social change. Like, storytelling is part of your mission because you're working on a problem. You are trying to change something. You're filling a gap in society and you need people on board with that. So to me, I think storytelling is just an inherent part of the mission. I don't think it can be separated into, like, this is a task that's done by the marketing department. I think it needs to be integrated into the culture of the organization.
I think that's a really powerful point. You know, one of the challenges that I've heard in the past is the different types of causes. So one might have a really obvious, you know, thing that they can talk about. You know, if a cancer charity, that can be very relatable to a lot of people because we've all experienced that. But perhaps another charity is not so relatable, you know, not as much as, like you said, they're sort of always pulling on the heartstrings. So, you know, just getting the message out of the cause and why you're doing what you're doing is important. But you know, how do you think you navigate that challenge as a charity who doesn't have, or a nonprofit who doesn't have, you know, as much of that sort of heartstring type story to tell?
So there are two things I want to say. One is that the charities that have those human facing challenges, they do have the clients. Their other challenge is to frame things ethically. And I was actually just at a conference in Melbourne in Australia, and they talked a lot about asset-based and strengths-based fundraising and storytelling. So not focusing always on the negative, trying to focus on the positive and the more inspiring. So that's the challenge for the people that have children that are suffering from a cancer diagnosis, or they have people that are suffering from, you know, substance abuse problems. I've worked with a lot of organizations that have these interesting, almost very complicated missions. So a great example is I've worked with an organization and they are an advocacy group, a think tank working to end chronic absenteeism in the United States. So they're called Attendance Works. They're fabulous. They're based in California. And one in three American children post-COVID is at risk of becoming chronically absent and missing so much school that it's going to be detrimental to their academic success. So that's their why. Like, they're focused on that. The issue that they have is that they're not going to tell the story of the kid who's chronically absent, because that's not ethical. That's not the strengths-based fundraising. It's also just they're dealing with a lot of minors and a lot of other issues. So the story they tell is the work that they do in the schools. So they work with school districts. They work with principals. They work with administrators to create this infrastructure and these programs that will encourage kids to come back into the schools. You can't say that in a tweet, right? You can't. It's very complicated. But the stories they're telling is more about the why and why this is important and their vision for a world where this is not happening and sort of talking about their solution a little bit more. So you don't have to have that client that comes to you and, you know, you don't have to have the alumni. You don't always have to have that person that is bearing their soul and talking about their personal story. You really can either talk from the third person, talk about the partners that you work with. And I work with a lot of like advocacy groups. They don't do client service at all. They do advocacy, but the policies that they are promoting are changing lives and really creating change. So it's almost going more high level with your storytelling, which is a challenge and it is definitely difficult, but it just requires that creativity because people are not going to pay attention. If you're just spouting out a bunch of statistics, but you're not providing context as to why do I care? It's that empathy piece. The empathy piece has to be there for me to pull out my wallet at the end of the day.
Yeah, and it couldn't be more true. I think, like what we kind of say as well, when sometimes it's difficult to get the cause across or get people on board. I mean,
that's our job though, right? Like, yeah. I mean, I've done it for years and I work with people, I work with small organizations. Our job is to get the cause across. Yeah. Our job is also to provide the service, but it is also to help people understand what the cause is.
That's it. And that's what everyone's trying to do, isn't it? But I agree that sometimes there are unique causes that are harder to get that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I've worked with really niche, tiny, rare disease organizations. So the Marfan Foundation. Have you heard of Marfan? No one has heard of Marfan. It is a very specific form of epilepsy. And the Marfan Foundation, they're national, but they know they're not going to have 10 million donors because it's not something that personally affects necessarily so many people. But they're trying to raise awareness about what it is and how to spot it. Because one of the things that happens is that when you get Marfan, a lot of the people, it's misdiagnosed. It's very, very often misdiagnosed. So they're trying to raise awareness around what it looks like, how to get a proper diagnosis, how to advocate for a proper diagnosis, how to talk to a doctor. They're just providing all this fantastic, actual, tactical information that's incredibly useful and valuable. And their community is on fire. Like, they are so excited about it. They do peer-to-peer fundraising every year. So like, while, you know, I'm not personally affected by Marfan, thankfully, but pretend like I had it, or so I would raise money from my community and they would give because of me. So they've almost activated these peer-to-peer fundraisers who are incredibly passionate about the cause that are fundraising with their own networks. So they're not trying to reach people that wouldn't care. They're not spending their money and their time and their effort spraying out advertising around this very rare disease. They're activating their community to spread the word and tell their personal stories and raise money that way. And it's been really effective for them.
And it's smart. You know what I mean? It's great because sometimes I think you can see that where you see a real big marketing budget or spend on something that's so unique or not heard of. And I've looked at myself or even supported and thought this is more challenging. This one is because, yeah, I don't think people are going to relate or be able to feel that empathy, which you need really to be able to give. And I've seen those campaigns and I've thought that myself, well, I don't know if this is the right approach for you to get them to give.
Exactly. No, I agree completely.
And you sort of almost get a stronger sense of community maybe with a smaller community, whereas a bigger community, whilst that's all, you know, still great, everybody's really close. They want to speak to each other, want to share much more stories potentially. And, you know, getting that word out.
And people know every year. So they've cultivated this group of ambassadors and they've cultivated their donors and they've cultivated their board members. And every year, you know, there's Marfan Awareness Month and they know that their ambassador is going to go out and raise money for Marfan Awareness Month. And it empowers them because a lot of them are parents that have children suffering from this or they're suffering from this. It's a chronic disease and they are empowered to make a change through asking other people to fundraise, but they're also providing awareness around the disease because they're posting on Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn and YouTube and saying, this disease exists in the world. Here's what it looks like. I'm suffering from it. I would love for you to donate towards a cure or donate towards prevention. So it's empowering them in that way. It's giving them like agency, but it's also raising awareness in an authentic way where it's not just sort of a billboard. It's like an actual person you know is telling you about it. And the personal stories are the most effective.
Always. That's the thing, isn't it? I was going to jump into events. When people who, you know, who have been affected by it or have managed to go do a whole 360, I remember one of the best events I've ever attended when I first started in this industry. I watched this video of this charity called Street Child, and they help people in Sierra Leone. And I was watching this video and I was like absolutely empowered, emotional. I saw all these things were happening. And then at the end, the lady from the video walked on stage and they flew her in from Sierra Leone. Yeah. And she had a standing ovation. It was super emotional. Everybody was giving. Mm-hmm. And they nailed it. It was so consigned. It wasn't like an hour either. It was like, video, I'm emotional. I feel it. Yeah. I want to help. But then the nugget was like, she was then like, I'm here. I'm able to tell you that I survived and I thrived. And then it was like, give. And I was like, credit card out, boom. Even I can give. It was such a great thing. So I think the personal story is so amazing.
100%.
So just while we're on events, now I just gave you an example of the way that the fundraisers tell their story at events. And I've always said this, especially at our future of fundraising events, that fundraisers are amazing at telling their story at events and getting people to give. And you know, for you, Julia, just so you understand as well, in America, you know, pledge moments or fund a need moments are a given and they're quite normalized. Mm-hmm. Outside of the US, they're still not there completely. A lot of fundraisers we speak to, they're like, I don't know if it's right. I don't know if people would like to just be asked in that way. Where, you know, in American fundraising, it's like, let's stand on the table. You need to give now. It's very different. So there's kind of two questions there, which is, you know, for people who are maybe outside of the US and are listening to this thinking, oh God, we don't do those things, but I'd love to do them. You know, do you have any advice for those people?
I don't want anyone to do anything that they're uncomfortable with, but I do think that we need to examine all of our individual relationships around money and things that we were taught. So a lot of fundraising mindset is like, I grew up in Massachusetts, very Yankee, very Puritan. You never talk about money. You never talk about how much you make. You certainly would never ask someone for money, maybe other than in a direct mail appeal. Very, very buttoned up, right? So I know in some parts of America, it is really customary, especially in like a religious setting, like maybe a church setting, to be very forthright about asking for money. But I know that a lot of people do have that mindset we were brought up with where we don't talk about it. It's impolite to talk about it. But then there are some cultures where like tithing and giving a portion of a percentage of your income is something that you just do. I mean, it's just something that you're brought up with. So I guess my advice is be responsive to the community that you're in, learn about it, and don't do anything that you're not uncomfortable with. Also, there are ways to do storytelling that are empowering and that do give agency to the person that is sharing their story. You might need more guardrails and safeguards around your storytelling, depending on who you're collecting the story from. You might need processes and policies in place, especially if you're dealing with youth or marginalized populations or traumatized populations. I mean, you really might need those guardrails and a lot of policies and procedures around that. But I think asking for money, like what I know about fundraising is one, I think it's a generous act. I think that we need to really express that our organizations, a lot of our organizations cannot exist without private funding. We just need to sort of lift the veil on that and say, we are not getting enough government funding, or we're not getting enough corporate funding. Like, we really need your support. But also, what I saw, especially during COVID, was that people were making donations because they felt powerless. They felt like they wanted to help, but they couldn't do anything. And giving money, even $10, was a really quick way that they could say, okay, I did something. It's our job as fundraisers, not only to show them that, you know, not only to convince them to give, but then to cultivate that donation afterwards, to show them that they're part of a community, that they did the right thing. They're part of a group of like-minded people trying to move the needle on a cause that they care about. And that's why I think fundraising seems so icky lately, because it's so transactional. So you don't want it just to be a transaction. You don't want it just to be like, you know, on Instagram, like, I bought a sweater and it came, you know, 5 weeks later and it didn't fit and it was horrible and there's no customer service and you can't return it. And like, you don't want your fundraising to be like that. Okay. You don't want to just get the donation and then never speak to the donor again. You want to make sure you're building that relationship with them, helping them understand that they're really part of this great cause and that we can't do our work. Like, we literally cannot do our work without them. But yeah, there's a lot of mindset stuff around asking for money and talking about money. And we need to, you know, look at that personally, but also look at it culturally and look at it in the context of our community. And I would never ask someone to do something that they weren't comfortable with. But we do have to realize, like, I think fundraising is a generous act. I think philanthropy is wonderful, and it's certainly one of the backbones of American society. But I really think this transactional view of fundraising needs to change. And that's why we often feel so icky and salesy about it. We need to look at it as building a deeper relationship with the person and not just like getting their credit card number and never speaking to them again.
And there's a lot of research, right, about how it makes humans happy to give.
It really does. Endorphins. You get endorphins.
Exactly. So I think it's recognizing that as well. You know, people going to events in the setting we were just speaking about, they want to be part of that moment in giving the money and really making the difference. So I think, you know, recognizing that they too want to be part of that. So, you know, they've got to have the opportunity to give at some stage, and alongside a story is probably the best time to do that.
But we also have to recognize, and I know you're seeing that, I mean, it's international, younger generations, they don't care that your charity has this big brand name. Like, they don't care that you've been around for 75 years. They don't care that you have this like fancy board. They care about the impact, and they care much more about stories. So we do need to shift our fundraising and marketing, I think, to reach the younger generations. We can't rely on our reputations as much anymore, like we can with baby boomers. We have to start really making ourselves more relelevant to younger generations.
100%. It's one of the hot topics that is coming up at the moment when we're doing our future fundraising sessions. In all five countries, the consensus was that fundraisers are really concerned around how to appeal to the next generation of donors, especially because as we're learning, the more research that we do around that different generation, they don't seem to necessarily want to go to a gala dinner or attend.
Oh, God, who has time and money? No one.
Yeah, isn't it? That is the question now. Is everyone seems to be asking us at the moment, well, how do I appeal to that different generation? What have I got to do? What tool is it I'm going to use? And we're like, you know what? We don't know yet. Years ago, you thought it's Facebook. Then you're like, no, that's declining. And now it's Instagram. Is it another tool? There's so many to look at. I mean, have you got any advice around that to try, or any success you know of the people who are managing to successfully appeal to younger generations?
So the big trend, at least in the US, is influencer marketing. And now when I say influencer marketing, I don't mean, you know, Taylor Swift, Beyonce, Kim Kardashian. Like, you know, there's micro influencers, nano influencers. There's a whole realm of influencers that you can tap into. All it means is someone that is connected to your cause that has an audience that is relevant to you. So Best Friends Animal Society, one of my favorite organizations here in the US, or national, they actually have a director of influencer relations, because what they found, and they don't pay people, I should say that straight out. They do not pay influencers. What they do is they look for people that are talking about like no-kill animal shelters or are talking about fostering animals. They have these keywords that they look for. Then they go and research the person, see if, you know, they're aligned with their cause and their values and their ethics. Like they're not, you know, a Nazi or something crazy, right? They're not like a QAnon person. So they have to do a lot of research around that. But then they reach out to them directly and they say, hey, like, we'd love to send you a sweatshirt and a mug. I wonder if you could help us, you know, we're promoting this specific campaign around XYZ. We'd love if you could just talk about it on your TikTok, on your Instagram reel, whatever it might be. So they do that very tactically, and it's worked out really well. Now, a lot of these influencers, I should say, they're not specifically fundraising. So some of them are fundraising. Some of them are more just like, hey, everybody, give best friends a follow, you know, which is great. They're building their audience. Or go to their website or something like that. It's a little bit of a soft ask. If they're running a campaign, they do have some influencers that will say, hey, everybody, chip in $5, $10. But the way that you're really going to increase your audience is getting in front of new audiences. And it's really challenging to do that right now organically on social media. So working, like figuring out who you can connect with, maybe it's just in your community, who you can connect with that has some clout, some influence, and asking them to partner with and promote you. Okay, so I've had a really hard imposter syndrome time calling myself an influencer, but I do feel like I can now officially call myself an influencer. It's so hard to say that because you sound so, it's such a, I hate that word, right? Because you sound like, oh, I'm just getting paid promotions for makeup or something. So there's a pride committee here in my town. And like, I'm on the school board and I have a, you know, Instagram following, and I have a pretty big following. And they were asking me, they just said, hey, would you mind posting about our event? Like on your social media, would you mind sending it out? Would you mind doing this? And I said, oh my gosh, of course. Like, of course I would. Like, this is a cause that I'm aligned with, right? And you're aligned with me. So just being strategic and not thinking like, oh, your influencers have to have 10 million followers, because that's going to be a lot harder to reach. I just think we need to be more collaborative and thinking about what are the relationships we want to build with other people in our community. We need to stop thinking about people as competition. That's another thing. Work with the nonprofits in your community, all right? You're all trying at the end of the day to lift up the integrity of the people or the cause or the places or the animals that you serve. All of you are working towards this. So I just don't know why we don't do enough collaboration and we don't talk to each other's audiences enough. I think we need to do that more.
Well, you know, we've just recorded another podcast and it's being released around the same time as this one, which is nonprofit collaboration. Should we do it more?
So
it's interesting. Yeah, we the whole debate has just happened around it and the outcome was absolutely. So it's interesting that you're saying that as well.
100%. You're not going to post a fundraising link for someone else on your page, but why wouldn't you share the great stuff that's going on at the library or the great stuff that's going on at your local food pantry or, you know, your historical society? I just think we're a community, and why I don't know why we don't lift each other up more in that way.
Definitely. And I'm going to see what you think about, in terms of storytelling and marketing and, you know, everything you specialize in, how are you seeing AI come into this?
Oh, that's so great. I do see a lot of content being created around AI and nonprofits. Now, AI is such a huge term. I mean, you could look at it like, oh, let's use AI in our fundraising software, which I've seen with some of my software partners. They're using it to really effectively personalize communication. They're using it to write a lot of their fundraising copy or like personalize it. I think that as long as you use it like a tool, you know, you're using it as a tool. I'm thinking of, you know, a thesaurus. Like, you have a thesaurus, you have Google, you have these different resources available at your disposal. Using you know, if you're it, like AI is such a huge term. So I'm going to say, you know, let's talk about like large language models like ChatGPT. That's a very specific AI tool. I adore ChatGPT. If you are like me and you just sometimes get writer's block and you can't operate from a blank page, I just typed into ChatGPT, write me a webinar description that is tactical for nonprofits around social media based on Seinfeld. Because I'm talking at a conference that's 90s themed. You wouldn't even believe the description. It is amazing. I was like, oh my God, this is so good. So it gave me some ideas that I can then go from. And it's a little too Seinfeldy, so I don't think I'll use all of it. But it gives you ideas. So what I would say is learn a lot about it, read a lot about it, use it in a way that's going to inspire your creativity and inspire your sort of creative process. And use it for research. Use it to distill complex topics. That's another great one. So Attendance Works, my client, oh man, they have so much on their website that is like, you are not going to read this unless you have a PhD in education. So you can put it on ChatGPT and say, create a blog post around this, or distill this as if I was a fourth grader, or explain this to me like in the context of XYZ. And you're going to get a lot of good information and you're going to get some creative prompts that you can use. But I think AI for fundraising, that's going to be incredibly powerful. There's really no excuse to not know that someone donated. Like I get emails in December 31st, that say to me, oh, hey, Julia, I don't know if you had a chance to make your gift this year, but you know, you've got 24 hours to make it in this. And I'm like, no, I'm a monthly donor to you. Like, why do you not know that? Or like, I made my gift online. And there's no excuse to not know a little tiny bit about your donors. So I think the expectation with AI is that we live in this consumer world that's driven by AI. Like you open Amazon, what are you going to just go from a blank page? Netflix, Hulu, anything that you do, you go from Spotify. Can you imagine if you open up Spotify and it just like didn't know the music you liked? Like that wouldn't be okay. So I think we're going to go to this world with nonprofits where especially younger generations are going to expect some degree of personalization, some degree of like, you know, I've given $10 a month, or you know, I gave $200 at that gala. And personalizing the communications and segmentation. So that's a long-winded answer because I think, but I'm so interested to see. I'm hoping that it's going to make our workflows more effective and efficient. That's what I hope. I could talk for like 7 hours about AI.
No, I could honestly, I don't know how old the one on AI as well. So it's very much on my mind at the moment. And it feels like, you know, I can tell that some people are fearful of it because I think, you know, when you think about like Terminator and those kind of...
Well, 2001, A Space Odyssey, every movie, look at Megan, movie with AI, it's like ends badly for humans. Every so we're going to train that it's going to end badly.
That's it. I was actually...
Terminator, yeah, exactly.
I sat with a bunch of developers the other day and was talking about it. And they're like, everyone's thinking the AI is that level. They're like, it's not even that intelligent yet. It is a really good resource. But I think for some reason, I've spoke to some fundraisers, they're like, well, I'm out of a job. And I'm like, I don't think you are. I think you've just got to try and embrace it. And actually, like just ChatGPT, I wrote some auction items the other day. And I was like, I said, can you make an auction item about this villa?
Yeah.
And then he asked me questions back. And I was like, oh, yeah. And then boom, better than I could ever have imagined.
And I don't think it's cheating because our job is to do our job more effectively. Like our job as fundraisers is to do more with less. So if there's a free tool out there writing the auction item description so you don't have to spend an hour, that is time well spent. And those are resources well spent. So this is how I see it. Our job is always to do more with less. We're always forced to do more with fewer resources. Why not use this tool to do those kinds of things? Like, let's just write, you know, the paragraph that we have, or let's make sure all these names are correct or in our annual report. Like it's almost like an assistant that you didn't know you needed, but people are always like, oh, it's cheating. I'm like, well, it's not cheating unless you actually cut and paste 100% of it and pretend that you wrote it. Like it's, I mean, it's not like journalism where people are, I mean, they might be doing that. And I think that's unethical, like copy and pasting from ChatGPT. But if you're using it to do research or do any kind of those small copywriting tasks, I think it's a great use of a tool.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And unfortunately, we've actually run out of time. I know. And honestly, I think we could have done a whole episode on AI.
I'm not the expert. I have a lot of feels about it. I love it.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Julia, for joining us today. I really hope you've enjoyed having this short little podcast with us. So to learn more about Julia, head over to her website, jcsocialmarketing.com. You'll also learn more about her work. You can pick up a copy of her books, Storytelling in the Digital Age, A Guide for Nonprofits and How to Build and Mobilize a Social Media Community for your nonprofit in 90 days. Julia is also an engaging speaker and runs various online courses to help fundraisers to make the most of the digital platforms. And most importantly, be sure to listen to her weekly podcast, Nonprofit Nation, with Julia Campbell, nonprofit being one word when you search for the podcast online. We really, really hope that you've enjoyed today's episode and found the content informative, and we would love to hear your thoughts. So feel free to email podcast@giveagy.com, where you can also make suggestions of future topics or guests you would love to hear on the show. Thank you again, and don't forget to hit subscribe or follow to listen and look out for our next episode. Thank you.